Good evening, everybody. My name's Tim Besley. I'm the director of the Suntory Toyota International Centres for Economics and Related Disciplines at the LSE, conveniently shortened to STICCARD. We're the sponsor of this lecture this evening, along with the economics department at the LSE. And I'm delighted to welcome John Vickers here this evening. John, as you know, is the chairman of the Office of Fair Trading, and he joined the OFT as Director General on October 1st in 2000, so he's been there some time now. Before that, he spent 2.5 years as Chief Economist at the Bank of England and as a member of the Monetary Policy Committee. But John is one of these unusual people who spans both public life and academic life, and prior to his departure, he was Drummond Professor of Political Economy at Oxford, a chair he got at a ridiculously early age in 1991. He remains on leave from that position during the term of his current appointment at the Office of Fair Trading. He's an expert in industrial organization, and he's written widely on topics such as privatization, regulation, and competition. Given that he spans these two sides of the street, if you like, I can think of no one better, really, better place to give us a lecture here at the LSE on a topic of such importance as abuse of market power. And I'm very pleased to welcome John this evening.
Thank you very much indeed, Tim, and it's a pleasure to be invited to give this lecture. My topic, as you say, is abuse of market power, which is not a new topic by any means. It's an old topic. It's one of the core issues in competition law and competition economics. But as you just said, Tim, it is a very important topic. The question is, what should the rules be governing the behavior of firms who have dominant market positions? And that is a very important question, because if those rules are too lax, then those firms, who perhaps account for quite a significant portion of economic output, will be able to do things which might be very much contrary to the public interest. On the other hand, if the rules are too tight in some sense, then there might be a strong inhibiting effect, a chilling effect on what those firms do in the marketplace, what they seek to do by way of innovative effort, and so on. So I think it is an important set of issues. It's one that I find, and I hope I can persuade you or at least hint at why, I think there are a number of very interesting issues here, not just in policy terms, but interesting intellectual issues as well concerning the law and economics in this area. And now, even though it's not a new topic at all, now is a particularly interesting moment, because there is much debate on both sides of the Atlantic about what the law and policy should be in this area. And in particular, the European Commission in Brussels, the competition directorate there, has just started a policy review. So in addition to the flow of casework that the European competition authorities have, or national authorities like the OFT have to deal with, there is some systematic policy thinking happening right now. And what I want to talk about is what some of the questions are in that review, and how economics might helpfully be able to contribute to them. I should say, the usual disclaimer, I'm giving these remarks in a personal capacity. They're not to be equated with OFT views, so let me make that clear up front. Just to put the slightly wider perspective, competition law, which I think even a very few years ago, before the UK got proper competition law, often used to be seen as a rather arcane subject, which was the preserve of specialists. It is now much more center stage in this country, much more center stage as part of economic policy, largely because of some new pieces of legislation. I won't be technical about this, but the Competition Act of 1998, which came into force 4.5 years ago, and the Enterprise Act of 2002, which came into force last year, are two landmark pieces of UK competition legislation, adding to and reforming what went before, which was much less satisfactory. And abuse of market power is one of three core elements of what competition law targets. The other two, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment, are the law against agreements between firms which are anti-competitive, of which the ultimate example is the cartel agreement, where a group of firms, instead of competing with each other, agree with each other to fix high prices against the consumer interest. That's the first element. The second is that competition law targets mergers that are anti-competitive. The great majority of mergers are not anti-competitive, but some actual, and I'm sure many potential mergers, would be seriously anti-competitive. And it's one of the tasks of competition law to prevent or at least remedy the anti-competitive effects that such mergers might have. And abuse of market power, these are the rules governing the behavior of individual firms that individually have very strong market positions. That's the third element. So I'm going to be talking about one of the three chunks of what competition law seeks to do. I thought I should begin with an example to give you an idea of the kind of question. So here is a case example. I wonder if any of you will recognize the case I'm talking about here. It's a very big case, in fact. It was about a large American company. The industry is a computer industry. And the dominant position, or at least the alleged dominant position in this case, is about this company having a proprietary standard, which, although it's not absolutely universal across the industry, in this case it was it's a predominant standard adopted by the vast majority of users. So gave rise to very considerable market power and questions about abuse of that market power. And in particular in this case, the questions are whether the company's bundling of different elements of the package they're offering, whether that bundling was abusive, and also whether they were making life too hard for actual and potential rivals by not disclosing in an adequate way the information to those rivals that would allow the rivals to have their rival computer products operate with those of the firm with the dominant standard. Very big case, American and European cases. The American one got going and indeed concluded before the European one. And because today is today, I'm going to give you one more clue about this case, which is to say when it began in the US, there was a Democrat in the White House, and when it finished, there was a Republican in the White House. So which case am I talking about? Well, a number of you might think I'm talking about the Microsoft case because everything I have said is true of that case. But in fact, if I show you who the president was when this case began, you will realize that I am not talking about the Microsoft case. Bill Gates was 13 when this case began, and perhaps he was already working hard in the garage developing things, but I'm actually talking about the IBM case, or pair of cases, the American one and the European one. So Lyndon Johnson was the president. The case was launched by the American Justice Department on, I believe, the very last day, or the last full day, of his administration, just before the inauguration in 1969. And so that's under who the case began. Now, I said it finished under a Republican president, so who might that be? Well, that's who succeeded Johnson. We all know he was Republican. Did it finish under Nixon? No, it didn't. Kept going. Then we had Gerald Ford. Now, did it finish under Gerald Ford? No, case kept going. So we're now in the mid to late 70s. Then we had Jimmy Carter. Well, it can't be him I'm talking about because he was a Democrat, so it didn't finish under him. In fact, there we are. It was under Ronald Reagan that the IBM case in the US was concluded. Essentially, it was dropped by the the Reagan administration people in the Justice Department Antitrust Division. Now, what are the lessons from that? Well, one is clearly that some antitrust cases, competition cases, take a very long time. This one took 13 years to get a result or a non-result, really, as the case may be. Another thing what one sees is that was the sort of computer we were talking about then. This was began before Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon. So computers then were very big things. I suspect a number of you have in your bags or about your person equipment with more computing power than you would have found in an IBM 370 computer, which were these mainframe computers of the day. So computers were very different size then. I think the case also shows, for all the talk we've had recently about the new economy, there were cases about dominant network standards and innovation and all that a very long time ago. And for me, the case is of great personal interest, because my summer job when I'd finished my undergraduate degree was working on this case as a little bunny junior assistant economist on behalf of IBM. So this was my introduction to the competition law and economics of abuse of market power, abuse of dominance. Now, I also mention this because in the life of this case, from the late 60s to the early 80s, the prevailing economic thinking and its influence on the law in the US changed radically. In the 1960s, the economics that applied in this area and that was current in the law was, subsequently shown to be, in many respects, woefully inadequate, and it was prone to, without making comment on this particular case, in general prone to excessive intervention. A lot of mergers that would now be a universal consensus were not anti-competitive. A number were blocked under the standards prevailing at the time. For those of you who are studying industrial economics, the so-called new industrial organization had not really got off the ground. It was just getting off the ground at the very end of this case. About 1982 is a year when a lot of the key papers in that neck of the woods were published. But it was through the 70s, building on a tradition that went back a couple of decades out of the University of Chicago in particular, that economic thinking in this area of competition law and its application to the law, work done by people like Richard Posner, also Robert Bork, and a host of others, was fantastically influential. And you can see judgments even at the level of the US Supreme Court in the late 70s folding in this thinking, which were very, very different from judgments even a decade earlier. So even though not a word had changed in the relevant statutes, in the wording of the law, its interpretation and its application had changed enormously at the very highest level in the US. And that, I think, shows how ideas really matter for good or ill. I mean, I think in this case, a number of benefits that came from this Chicago thinking, which showed some of the woolier thinking earlier to be inadequate to the task. So ideas matter. And even when the wording of the law doesn't change, we're in an area here where a lot of the law is, in effect, judge-made, ideas can matter a great deal, and evolution can happen sometimes quite rapidly. Now, that was one example. Let me now turn to some remarks about competition policy reform in the EU, in the European community. This is relevant to us in the UK, not only because we're a member state of the European Union and the number of the big cases are dealt with in Brussels, the transnational cases. It also matters because for the last 4 years or so, our law has been a direct import of European law. Not only, you look at the wording of the key provisions of the UK's Competition Act, those echo precisely, more or less precisely, the provisions of European competition law, which have been in place for in force for 40-odd years. So it's domestic law as well as European law which we're talking about here. And you could say the same for many other member states too. Now, what we've seen in the last 5 years or so is some significant reform under the first two of the three headings that I mentioned earlier. So in respect of anti-competitive agreements and mergers, there has been a shift, at least of degree, from, and I stress it's of degree, I don't wish to make the claim it's a radical change, and what has changed is that we now have increasing emphasis on economics-based and economics-anchored approaches, and perhaps a bit less emphasis on the legalistic formalism which coloured some of the more long-distant cases. So this is an evolution, but there have been some particularly important developments in the last few years. Under the heading of anti-competitive agreements, emphasis, again of degree, has shifted from what I think was really a primary focus, if you look at the Brussels caseload, on vertical agreements, where, say, a manufacturer has arrangements with a retailer, where a lot of the early cases, partly because of the single market objectives of the European community, had to do with things like territorial restrictions on what retailers could do, things of that kind. Now, that bit of law carries on, and it carries on being applied. but we've seen in the last few years heightened emphasis on pursuing hardcore cartel activity, the horizontal agreement where firms at the same level of the supply chain get together in an illegal agreement to charge high prices, give bad deals to consumers rather than competing. A lot of this was influenced by the manifest success in the United States, where by changing the incentives to information providers, if you like, whistleblowers, firms that came forward and told the authorities, we have been in a cartel, we fess up, they can be given amnesty or leniency arrangements. So the U.S. authorities got onto a number of cases. Cartel activity is generally done in secret. And they unearthed and exposed and penalized with follow-on private actions in the U.S. that sort of cartel activity. Now, European Commission in Brussels and member states like the U.K., the OFT, has been seeking to do this as well. We've been focusing as well on a number of the anti-competitive vertical agreements. There's been quite a big push on horizontal agreements, and that, I think, makes a lot of economic sense. In the area of vertical agreements, the interpretation of the law there has explicitly become much more economics-based than was the case in the past. So at least in those respects, we're in a more economics-oriented set of arrangements. And since 1st of May this year, for the last 6 months, the old bureaucratic notification system, which used to exist in Brussels for anti-competitive agreements, has now gone. So we're now in a regime where parties and their lawyers are much more in the business of self-assessment, which is how commercial law operates on many wider fronts, and I think that makes sense as well. Secondly, under mergers, the European merger regulation, that too was revised 6 months ago, again towards a more economics-oriented approach underpinned by economics-based guidelines from the authorities in Brussels. So there again, we've had a more economics-oriented approach applied. But the third element has not yet been subject to the systematic review that the first two have, and that review has just got underway now in the last few months. And I think it will be a big topic on the European competition policy agenda for a number of months to come before the European Commission, as well as dealing with the flow of cases that we'll have to deal with, may come out with some guidance or guidelines or a consultative paper or whatever it might be. But this is a real systematic policy think. The kind of issues are balance between should the law strike at agreements of a particular description, a particular form, or should it be much more oriented to the economic effect or potential economic effect of practices by single firms under abusive market power. Another question opened up is whether European law and policy is perhaps in a very different place from US law and policy. If so, does that matter? Well, probably does matter, because for international business, there are issues arising from that, difficult issues if you've got different law in different places. I have to say it's far from clear whether there are those differences or how great they are, because within the US, there is a great deal of uncertainty about a number of questions under the heading of abusive market power, just as there is within the EU at the moment. So as well as inter-jurisdictional uncertainty, there is intra-jurisdictional uncertainty as well. Of course, the world isn't only the EC and the US. There are a number of, some very interesting cases from places like New Zealand, Far East, Australia, other places too, which are recent or current. I believe a very important deep issue, which in my view must be tackled in this review, is one of underlying principles. When you have a treaty provision dealing with abuse of dominance, saying that that's against the law, incompatible with the common market, and you've got a number of cases, which perhaps isn't a very big number, stretching over 40 years in such an important area of law and economics, often the underlying principles are, if they're there at all, are concealed from view. And I think there would be great value in the European Commission and others, and perhaps through time the courts, being a bit more explicit about what the approach is. I think that would be good for consistency. It would be good for aligning the law with its purpose. And it would actually be good rather than bad for predictability. And then to economists, there's this interesting question, well, what role can we play in this? I'm of the view that this can't be left to the lawyers. I think economics has a lot to contribute to this debate. But what economics can contribute and how that is best contributed is less obvious, and I'll say a few remarks as I go along under that heading. So what I'm going to do is briefly sketch the law. I do it with great hesitation, given some of the people who are in the room, but I hope they will forgive my overview sketch, not to be taken as a statement of the law. I'll illustrate with a few, I'll mention a few cases involving questions of abuse of market power, questions to do with pricing behavior. It's not the only kind of behavior that comes under this description, but I'll mention a few pricing cases. There won't be time for me to elaborate on them. What I really want to get into is this quest for underlying principles. If there are underlying principles that can unite, make sense of the case law, or indeed going forward, might be principles that the case law could more explicitly embrace, what might they be? And I'm going to talk about the three candidates that you see there. Now, the law. In European Community Law, Article 82 of the EC Treaty prohibits abuse of a dominant market position. I'll have to say a bit in a moment about what a dominant position is. I won't put up or read out the entire text of that treaty provision. It's not very long, but it says that an abuse by one or more undertakings is prohibited, and such abuse may in particular consist in, and there's a list of four things. One is to do with unfair purchase or selling prices. The second is to do with limiting production and so on to the detriment, to the prejudice of consumers. Third is applying dissimilar conditions to equivalent transactions with other trading parties, placing them at a competitive disadvantage, a kind of price discrimination. And the last one is making the conclusion of contracts subject to, let me just call it, undue conditions, having too many strings attached, to put it extremely crudely. That's what Article 82 is about. And as I said, we've got the same provisions in our domestic law, as is the case in some other countries too. Now, I'll tell you a bit in a moment about the nature of the case law and the jurisprudence and the precedent which has built up in that area. But that's the EU law being in force for 42 years. The US goes back way longer. The Sherman Act was passed in 1890, so that's been on the statute book for 114 years in the US. In many ways, the European law is quite like the Sherman Act, because there's a prohibition on anti-competitive agreements and on monopolization and attempted monopolization. It's not the same words as abuse of dominance or abuse of market power. In fact, I think there's some quite important but fairly subtle differences, but it's clearly in the same general territory. So cases like the IBM case, or more recently the Microsoft case, those have been looked at under Section 2 of the Sherman Act and under Article 82, as it's now numbered, of the EC Treaty provisions. Now, the case law, what does the case law tell us? Well, the first thing, and I'll be focusing now on the European case law, first of all, there's no law against abuse full stop. There's no law against dominance. The law is a prohibition on abuse of dominant market positions. So the law applies only when the firm in question has a dominant market position. Now, what does that mean? How do you find out or establish when a firm has market dominance? Well, a step that you must go through is to define the economically relevant market. If you like, that's the sphere of competition within which the firm operates. So in the IBM case, we're talking then about mainframe. The Commission's market definition was IBM-compatible mainframe computers, of which IBM had an enormously high market share, surprisingly enough. IBM was contending for a much wider market definition, in which its share was a lot lower, and claimed that the future was going to be one of desktop computers linked by telecommunications networks, which, curiously enough, turned out to be true. Anyway, that was that case. When you've defined the relevant market, you then look at the market shares, in particular that of the allegedly dominant firm or the firm about which there are questions. You might look at the other firm's market shares, evolution of market shares over time, all sorts of other things. Even if it's a high market share, that doesn't prove dominance. You've got to look at whether entry barriers stopping potential competition. You might want to look at the buyer side of the market. Whole host of things that you've got to do to establish dominance. Now, there isn't time to say more about that unless you want to ask about it in questions. But let's suppose that we've got a case where we've established, we're on strong grounds, that there is dominance. And the question is whether the conduct of the firm in question is against the law, is abusive, So something should be done about it, should be stopped, penalised perhaps, maybe private actions to follow on, people seeking damages from damage caused by it. Or should we just stand back and say, no, get on with it, that's competition. Life might be hard, but that's the way it is. There's no question of the law being broken. So what about the case law on abuse of dominance? Well, even though, as I mentioned to you, one potential heading of abuse of dominance is unfair prices, which might mean excessively high prices, that is not what most cases have been about. Very few cases under European law have been about that. The great majority have been about exclusionary practices, where the claim was that the dominant firm was unlawfully doing things which unlawfully excluded from the market or inhibited the growth of rivals and was unlawfully anti-competitive in that sense. So it's been about anti-competitive, in that sense, anti-competitive behavior rather than exploiting consumers. In the US, where the law is in that language of monopolization, all the cases are or virtually all about exclusionary or sometimes discriminatory practices and not about exploitative practices. Charging high prices in the US, that's not monopolization. That's what you might well do if you have a monopoly, but it's not something that you're doing to maintain or acquire a monopoly position. You're merely exploiting it, and that's not illegal in the US, though it can be, but only in a very narrow set of cases has been found to be in the UK. The subject matter of the cases has been about pricing and non-pricing issues. So third bullet point there has a list of pricing abuses that have been found in European cases. You'd have a similar list in the US. And at the bottom are some non-price issues. And in fact, the IBM case and the Microsoft case, the two I mentioned earlier, those are about non-price issues rather than pricing issues. Now, for economists, you think, well, what's the difference between a pricing issue and a non-pricing issue? Refusal to supply, technically, is a bit like saying, I'll supply you only at an exorbitant, prohibitive, infinite price. So the dividing line between the two categories isn't absolutely tight. What I'm going to do in my examples is talk about pricing issues. Now, what have the courts said about abuse? How have they sought to characterize, in terms of general principles, that treaty provision, Article 82? How have they tried to give meaning to that? Well, one thing that they have said clearly is that a dominant firm has a special responsibility, not one faced by non-dominant firms, not to distort competition. They have said, secondly, in a line of cases, that abuse consists in recourse to methods other than those which condition normal competition, or recourse to methods different from competition on the merits. That's a phrase you find in some US cases too. The European courts have also said that abuse of dominance is an objective concept. So to show, if I'm the dominant firm, you don't need to show that I deliberately did the thing in an anti-competitive way for it to be abusive. I can be found to have broken the law by abusive conduct without that intent. If I fail to obey my special responsibility not to distort competition, then I can be found to have committed abuse. So those are some general thoughts that have come from the courts in the EC. In the US, and again, there's a very long line of cases, and a number of these, some of the language here, or in the paper that I'm basing my remarks on, which I'll give you details of later, there is some judicial language, sometimes from decades ago, which echoes again and again in cases at the very highest level, Supreme Court, as well as the federal appeal courts and the district courts and the whole works in the US. And there are really two key ingredients to establish a monopolization claim in the US. One is that the firm has monopoly power. Second, that it's to do with willful acquisition or maintenance of that power. So there are more shades of intent in that language than you'd find in European law. And the courts have very carefully distinguished that from having a strong market position, even monopoly power, on the basis of a superior product, business acumen, or indeed sheer luck. If you've got a monopoly position on the basis of luck, you have not broken the monopolization law in the US, and indeed you wouldn't have done in the EU until you start abusing it. And the courts constantly say the key question is to distinguish the exclusionary, unlawful exclusionary behaviour from pro-competitive behaviour. You see that again and again and again. Very good recent example being the US Court of Appeals in the Microsoft litigation very recently in the US. The US case of Microsoft has been resolved. The EU case carries on, is on appeal before the European courts in Luxembourg, and I don't want to say any more about that case in part for that reason. So, quite a lot of commonality between the judicial pronouncements on both sides of the Atlantic. And a lot of it really comes down to these key questions. What is undistorted or distorted competition? How can you tell the difference? What's normal competition? What's competition on the merits as distinct from the unlawful exclusionary conduct? So that is the key, those are the key principles. Now, if you start thinking about what they mean, have they answered the fundamental question about what is abuse or not? Or have they merely, have they restated the question? Somebody says, what's abuse of a dominant position? You say, aha, well, that's something which is not competition on the merits, but it's behavior that distorts competition. Well, that's more or less helpful, but it certainly doesn't get you to a final answer. And indeed, there are a number of scholars who are very critical at the lack of guidance that has come from the courts. Let me give you one example, one of my favorite examples of it. a pithy quote from the US. This is from someone called Ina Elhauger, who says in a very recent article, he's Harvard Law School, very eminent authority in this area. He says, monopolization doctrine currently uses vacuous standards and conclusory labels that provide no meaningful guidance about which conduct will be condemned as exclusionary. Now, I don't know quite what the word conclusory means, but you know, you get the message. He's very critical about this. And the fact that he's saying that about the US law underlines the point that these debates are not just European debates with the review of policy in this era, but there are live issues in the scholarly debate as well as in cases case by case, which are always litigated to the nth degree in the US about what law and policy is or should be in this area. So let me now give you a few examples. I'm just going to mention some cases, and then I want to get on to what the underlying principles might possibly be. Predatory pricing. Predatory pricing is where a dominant firm charges very low prices, perhaps deliberately incurring losses in the short run, to drive competitors out of its market or markets, or to deter rivals from entering its market or markets, so that it gets or keeps a monopoly position in the long term, and it can gouge consumers with high prices after this burst of low pricing into the further future. So it's monopolizing the market, it's maintaining or acquiring its monopoly position by low pricing. Of course, it's good for consumers in the short run, but it's going to be bad for them if the theory is true in application to a particular case in the longer run. There's been a great debate about how interventionist, how ready should a competition authority like the OFTB to intervene in a case and say, whoa, you stop that. Those prices are much too low. That's anti-competitive pricing. We know you're doing it just to charge higher prices in the long run. That'll be against the consumer interest. You must not price that low. There'd been a great debate. There was a school of thought associated with the Chicago tradition mentioned earlier that there were never, or almost never, any cases of this kind. One of the arguments being this low pricing by the big firm is going to cost the big firm a great deal more in terms of lost profit than it's inflicting damage on the small rival or rivals. It's just not a rational thing for a dominant firm to do compared with the alternatives in front of it. So they're used in the US, though I think perhaps never on this side of the Atlantic, incredulity about this as a pricing strategy. And that would counsel a very, very cautious approach in terms of intervention. You see low pricing on that Chicago view of those days, you'd say the authorities should just say, well, that's great. You know, competition's all about good deals for consumers. Don't interfere. Don't get in there with the consequence that you'll raise prices against consumers, maybe make life easier for inefficient competitors, but you'll be doing economic damage to consumers in the long run. Now, one of the things that the new industrial organization did in the 80s was to show that attitude of incredulity, the argument that it's just irrational for a firm to engage in that kind of pricing, was wrong, and that there were circumstances, typically to do with reputation effects or signaling effects, where a firm is trying to establish a reputation for being an aggressor in markets so that people will leave its markets and it will not seek to enter markets it might have elsewhere, other local markets, for example, show that reputation effects could well make predatory pricing rational. Or indeed, there might be financial stories about financial constraints on the rivals, where the dominant firm doesn't have such constraints, where, again, the pricing pattern that I described could be an entirely rational strategy. That's in theory. Now, of course, something being the case in theory doesn't begin to make it true in any particular case. That all depends on the facts of cases. But this was an important development because it showed that the Chicago-style argument, this is never going to happen, was just wrong as a matter of theory. It could well happen. It's not an empty box we were talking about. So what the courts did, again, on both sides of the Atlantic and the various scholars I could mention, a lot of this came from academic thinking, who developed tests to do with whether the questioned pricing was below certain measures of cost. And I don't want to get technical in this public lecture, but one of the litmus tests is whether if a dominant firm is pricing below even its variable costs, so never mind contributing to overheads, it's not even covering all its direct costs. If you see pricing of that kind, then in Europe, if there's a dominant firm, there is a presumption, can be rebutted in some circumstances, that is abusive dominance, contrary to the law, kind of predatory pricing. And in the US, if a firm with monopoly power should be shown to be pricing below an appropriate measure of costs, wonderful phrase which gives rise to an immense amount of argument, that's not the end of the case, but that firm would be very much in the frame for predatory pricing findings. Also in European law, you can be found to have unlawfully engaged in predatory pricing as a dominant firm if your pricing, even though above your variable costs, is below your average total cost, if there is supplementary evidence of anti-competitive intent. So there it's again to do with a cost-based standard, but with intent evidence being relevant in the story too. Fourth bullet, I mentioned two UK cases, they're both Scottish cases actually. Aberdeen Journals was a local newspaper case where the OFT made a finding which was upheld by the Competition Appeal Tribunal that Aberdeen Journals, which is part of a much larger newspaper group which operates in many local markets, had been doing predatory pricing of advertising space against an attempt to drive a rival out of the market. Edinburgh, that's described with references in the paper that I'll mention, I'll give you details at the end. Edinburgh Buses was a case where we did not make a finding. I wanted to give you sort of balanced one infringement decision, another case where we did not make a finding of these. Edinburgh Buses, you had a bus company with which we didn't make conclusions on the question of dominance, but on the evidence might have a dominant position in the area around Edinburgh, was expanding services and pricing low within the city. There were complaints from the company that is the main operator in the city saying this is predatory pricing. We looked at the evidence, looked at their relative market positions and the situation as a whole, and we concluded that the evidence did not stack up to show a finding of abusively low pricing, that this was a business expansion in an area where the firm in the surrounding area had, relatively speaking, less of a presence, and was in that sense pro-competitive rather than anti-competitive. So we were taking a view on this question, which side of the line was that pricing on? And that was one, and we issued a public statement about this, which you can find on our website, where we did not make a finding of abuse. American Airlines, fascinating US case recently, where the American authorities had court judgment against them. It was to do with American Airlines in its around its Dallas hub, expanding capacity, cutting prices. Very interesting case for economists, because the US government case was that even though the fares weren't below the directly attributable variable costs on the routes in question, if you took into account the lost profit on existing capacity and you factored that opportunity cost into the cost analysis, this is all sounding a bit techy, but actually it's a very important point of law and economics, that it was below cost on that basis. The American court, the appeal court, didn't like that argument, so it threw out the case. But it did say, and this points to the comment at the top bullet, that while they approached predatory pricing case allegations with caution, they did not do so, quotes, with the incredulity which once prevailed. A very interesting remark, and shows the influence of some of the post-Chicago, more game theory-influenced thinking of the last 20 years. A very important issue in the US is not just whether how the pricing squares with costs, it's also whether there is a probability, one court case, a dangerous probability, that the dominant firm, through this pricing, will recoup the losses, the profits foregone, by subsequent high pricing. And in the US, under the law as it stands, you have to show that as well as the below cost element, whereas in Europe you don't, not, well, at least you don't as a general proposition. So there's a few predatory pricing cases. There are also a number of cases about price cuts where dominant firms have cut price when a competitor has turned up, but without conclusive evidence that they were cutting price to below cost. So we weren't in the predatory under the predatory pricing label earlier, and there's a case to do with shipping on routes between Europe and West Africa, a case called Compagnie Maritime Belge, where again, just a few years ago, there was important judgment from the European Court of Justice about this selective price cutting, where they've upheld a finding of abuse of dominance without evidence that there was below-cost pricing. And the court there was saying, well, you know, there is a danger here about such an approach. This wasn't their language, but clearly the thought was there that if such price cuts are unlawful, that might hold a pricing umbrella above rival firms, might not be in the interest of consumers, might be good for rivals, it might be good for the inefficient rivals. Well, that's not good for economic efficiency. So a very tricky balancing exercise here. One view would be to say, well, just if it's above cost, let the dominant firm get on with it, never intervene. There are some people of that view. Others would say, well, you should sometimes intervene, and maybe Compagnie Maritime Belge is a classic case in point. And some might say, well, you should always combat selective price cuts of that kind. But I think that policy, saying you should always combat it, that the law should be hostile more generally, is a very dangerous way to go, because it would chill a lot of pro-competitive, pro-consumer behavior. So how can we distinguish between what is should be lawful and what should not? You get similar issues in the area of conditional price cuts, where, say, a manufacturer says to retailers, if you buy at least this amount, or if you buy X percent more from me than you did last year, or if you have an exclusive agreement to buy only from me, then you get discounts. Well, superficially, in a way, that sounds pro-competitive, because it's to do with discounts and lower prices. On the other hand, there are certainly circumstances where that could be anti-competitive in some sense. Again, how do we draw the line? Two much debated European cases recently, one involving Michelin tires, which is very much the kind of situation I just mentioned, one involving British Airways dealings with travel agents. European Commission found against the loyalty kind of rebates that those firms who were held to be dominant firms in the relevant markets were offering their distributors, and made abuse of dominance findings against them. The British Airways case, well, both were appealed to the Court of First Instance in Luxembourg. Both cases upheld what the European Commission had done, and the British Airways case is now on appeal to the higher court, the ultimate court in Europe, European Court of Justice. And the argument against these practices were that they were loyalty-inducing, they foreclosed the market, and that they didn't have a sufficiently compelling direct cost justification for the discounts. Well, without wishing to comment particularly on those cases, again, in this territory of discounts and rebates, very difficult line to draw between what superficially could be pro-competitive but superficially can be anti-competitive. How do we dig down and decide where to draw the line? And I think what would be incredibly helpful, but which does not automatically come from law cases, is greater clarity about what the underlying principles are. Can more be said to distinguish between competition on the merits and distorting abusive competition? And I think that's important for a number of reasons. One is it involves sort of a sense of ad hocery, each case looked at in isolation, and the appeal, you know, cases that go to appeal are not a representative sample of all cases, and cases that an authority like the OFT looks at, in a way, are not a representative sample of all competition matters that lawyers and companies out there are considering and making decisions about in their day-to-day business. So a bit more clarity, or indeed a lot more clarity about underlying principles would, I think, be very helpful. it would be a kind of glue or binding that would help consistency and clarity about what the law is. So it would help predictability too. It would help align the law with its purpose, which I believe to be primarily an economic purpose. And it would give a kind of an anchoring for case analysis in economic principle. I say economic principle, I distinguish that from the latest economic theory. Now, the latest economic theory can be very important and can help economic principles evolve, and it certainly has. The Chicago School I mentioned was very influential. The New Industrial Organization or Game Theory Influence School was too. But I mention that distinction because a number of people, some who favor legalistic approaches, say, well, it's all very well for me as an economist, you know, to say, well, let's have more economics in it. But, you know, economists are always disagreeing with each other, these convoluted journal articles that no one except the high priest can understand. That is no basis to take the law forward. Well, actually, I would agree if that was the only alternative. But I do think there's a strong basis and opportunity for economic principle educated and evolving through time on the basis of theory and empirical work and so on as a stronger anchor for case analysis. So I want to spend the remaining time having a little look at three possible candidates. It's all very well to say we need some underlying principles, but what might they be? I'll explain these candidates. They all have some groundings in case law. It's not just roots, but arguably even green shoots for some of these principles in the case law. And maybe it would be a good thing if they got more debate and evolved to have a stronger basis for the law and the casework that we all have to deal with and that businesses have to work out for themselves in this area. Those three candidates, let me just hook them back to predatory pricing, which I talked about. The sacrifice test is all about whether a firm is, the dominant firm is sacrificing profits in the short run in order to have market power to exploit monopoly power in the longer run. So one candidate would say, well, if it's sacrifice behavior, that sacrifice of short-run profits, perhaps that's the way in. Perhaps that's going to be a guiding principle that can help us discriminate the lawful from the unlawful. And my description of the predatory pricing cases had an echo of that. I also spoke about cost benchmarks. That might link into a test, and I'll elaborate in a moment, that tried to distinguish between behavior that excluded competitors who were as efficient or more efficient than the dominant firm. Maybe that should be a guiding principle as to what is competition on the merits and what's not. Maybe, this will be the third candidate, it should be a test to do with consumer harm, that only if there's harm or probable harm to consumers that the law should intervene. And that would link to the recoupment point I made in the context of predatory pricing. So these three candidate principles are not out of thin air. You can find roots, shoots of them in the underlying case law. And let me now turn to them in turn and make some what are meant to be constructively critical comments. I should say, don't want to raise expectations, I do not have the answer on this front, but I do believe that candidates of this kind could do with more discussion and airing. The sacrifice test, then, essential idea is to ask, here's this conduct. Firm is dominant, let's assume. So assume that's been established. Is it the case that the conduct makes no business sense but for its exclusionary effect? Is that going to be a good way of distinguishing between what is lawful and what is unlawful? And this seems kind of intuitive because the predatory pricing cases, they fail the test, so they'd be condemned. But where a firm is just meeting competition when competition strengthens, dominant firm, that would not fail the test. That would be lawful. So that seems all rather natural and intuitive. But when you start thinking about it, it's not clear that it does give you, maybe very useful, but it's not clear that it does give you the anchor that you were looking for. And the glib way of making that point is to say, if I say behavior is exclusionary, if it makes no business sense but for being exclusionary, it's not clear I provided a definition of exclusionary. I clearly haven't. I've just gone round in a possibly educative circle, but I've really just gone round in a circle, and I haven't anchored myself in any firm ground. So while this might be a useful test of willfulness or intent in jurisdictions where that's a key element, it doesn't, on the face of it, doesn't by itself say what is exclusionary. Also, when you start to think what this test would mean if you tried to make it operational, it doesn't. There are a number of issues you've got to specify. Sacrifice, easy word, intuitive, natural in some ways, but sacrifice relative to what? Is it sacrifice relative to the most profitable strategy? Well, that seems a bit funny, because then you'd be saying to the firm, go forth and charge monopoly prices, otherwise you're in trouble under the law. That doesn't seem a very sensible way to go. Now, one way to meet that criticism is to say, well, wouldn't mean that in practice. It's only if you could show that behavior was egregiously less profitable than what was profit maximizing. But that's not a very good defense, it seems to me, of this test, because it's rather like saying, a test that is less bad in practice than it is in theory is a good test, and that's clearly a non sequitur. Another way to go might be to say, well, if you're looking at a change in strategy, like American Airlines suddenly expanding its the planes and capacity on these routes the moment entrants turned up and cutting its prices, perhaps if it's sacrificed relative to what was previously happening, perhaps that's a benchmark for you. Or is it a sacrifice relative to producing a bit less, which might be linked into the variable cost test I mentioned earlier in the context of predation? You've got to specify what you're talking about as the benchmark if this test is going to do a lot of work for you. And it's not totally obvious which way to go. There's been a lot of controversy in the US on the particular question of whether sacrifice should be a necessary ingredient for finding of abuse. There are some who would say, unless the sacrifice test is shown, then it's not an abuse. So you might have cost tests and other things as well, but this view would say only if you can show in addition that there's been profit sacrifice, that the conduct makes no business sense but for its anti-competitive effect, that unless you can show that too, then you should not make a finding of abuse. Well, that's certainly not where the European law is. The US government, in its amicus curiae, friend of court briefs to the US Supreme Court in a recent case called Trinco, on which the Supreme Court gave judgment earlier this year, so I'm talking about a number of very recent cases, the US government more or less invited the Supreme Court to bless this principle in the context of refusal to supply cases. The Supreme Court said nothing about it, so it didn't take that particular point one way or the other. But the attempt by the US government, Justice Department, to do that led to a great deal of debate and controversy. And there are a number who take the view that it should certainly not be a necessary condition for finding of unlawfulness that sacrifice is shown. And there's some quite interesting, very recent work being done, for example, by the US Federal Trade Commission, coming out of cases of alleged cheap exclusion, where a firm might have done something that cost it nothing. May have, for example, got, if I persuade you, if we're deciding which industry standard we should have, if we all agree to adopt some standard and we sign on the dotted line and say, aha, by the way, I didn't tell you, but I have a patent on that standard, and I'm now going to charge you the earth for using it. Take that hypothetical example, abuse of my kind, that might cost me nothing, but could be very exclusionary in effect. So there's a big debate going on around that in the US. And my own conclusions on this, that while the sacrifice test question might be a useful one to ask as part of the assessment, particularly on intent issues in jurisdictions where that matters, I think it's clear that it cannot by itself say what is exclusionary, that there are some big specification issues about what's the benchmark against which you judge sacrifice. And so this isn't going to be the solution, the grand solution to the problem. Maybe part of the solution, but it's not a total solution. And you can't get away from the fundamental question, even if you adopt the sacrifice test, of what is harm to competition? What is the unlawfully exclusionary behavior? Now, one way to approach that question is to say, well, perhaps we should think, whose exclusion are we seeking to protect against by this part of law? And a rather natural approach, I'm not saying it's necessarily absolutely compelling, a rather natural approach would be to say, exclusion of competitors who are as efficient or more efficient than the dominant firm. There's a great danger in this whole area that competition law, if misapplied, could protect all sorts of inefficient competitors. They could say, oh, we don't like this low pricing, we don't like this new product from the dominant firm. Oh, OFT, please stop them doing that because we're going to go out of business unless you do. And that would not be a good policy approach because all sorts of inefficient competitors could be propped up and a number of consumer benefits lost in the process. So one fairly natural way to draw the line between excessive competitor protection and, on the other hand, trying to protect the competitive process might be in terms of as efficient competitors. There is some pedigree in case law, including European case law, for this, and there are very eminent US figures, including Richard Posner, who is, by the way, now a judge on the number of years been a judge on the Court of Appeals. That's one level below the Supreme Court in the US. And he's advanced in his textbook in this area the following standard: that the plaintiff, for a showing of what we would call abusive of dominance, monopolization, must first prove that the defendant has monopoly power, and second, that the challenged practice is likely in the circumstances to exclude from the defendant's market an equally or more efficient competitor. So that's his suggestion. It ties in with economic logic, at least to some degree. If you think one of the benefits of competition is efficiency, productive efficiency, the as efficient competitor test strikes a chord with that. But open to a number of questions and objections. Is it too permissive? There may well be circumstances where rivalry, even if the rival isn't as efficient or isn't yet as efficient as the dominant firm, might be good news for consumers and for productive efficiency, spur of competition, more spur towards efficiency, innovation, and so on. And even if one took the view perhaps in general one shouldn't be too interventionist, if you've got price cuts, say above costs, that are selective price cuts or are conditional on exclusivity or loyalty or whatever, remember the cases I talked about a few moments ago, maybe policy in those targeted areas should be more interventionist. So those might be some criticisms of the as efficient competitor test, saying it's too, if you like, too conservative. There might be cases where you'd want to intervene even if competitors, even if the viability of competitors as efficient as the dominant firm is not threatened. Now, the one key point I want to make under this heading before turning to consumer harm test, and then I'll wrap up, is about this context where you might have a firm, dominant firm, which is big, say it's got scale economies, its rivals, maybe fledgling rivals, may at their current scale of operation have much higher unit costs because they haven't got down the learning curve, they haven't got the scale economies in place. So those firms, even though they might be as efficient or more efficient for any scale of operation, it's just because they're so small they've got higher unit costs. So you might say extending the as efficient competitor logic to looking at whether their cost curves as a whole, how they stand in relation to those of the dominant firm, whether they might be inefficiently excluded by certain practices by the dominant firm. And there's no doubt, there's a line of economic theory literature, that this certainly can happen. You can have loyalty discounts excluding rivals from a market who might be more efficient than the dominant firm for any given scale. Just because they're little, they haven't achieved the scale economy benefits, so they're shut out. The dominant firm, I might be able, dominant firm, bribe each of you to stick with me. I'll say, look, I'll give you a discount if you're exclusive to me. Individually, you might say, well, you know, the alternative is going to that tiny little firm over there, very inefficient at the moment, so small. So, yeah, I better sign up to the exclusive deal. Then Tim's firm, the alternative firm, can never get a foothold in the market, and I chug along with my nice big monopoly. Now, that can all be coherent in theory. Whether it's true in any particular case depends, however, on the facts. It depends on things like how important are scale economies, how much of the market is foreclosed. You've got to ask those quantitative questions to see whether the theory is true on the facts. If you're just told that I'm operating such a discount scheme, it seems to me it'd be far too quick to conclude that I have abused a dominant position. There might be all sorts of reasons why I've done that in terms of business logic. I may have got you to sign these exclusive arrangements because if I hadn't, Tim might have been free riding on all sorts of investments that you and I might have made together. So unless you ask these questions of facts in an economic framework, it seems to me that the pure form of the conduct can't give you a sensible answer as to whether it should be prohibited under the law or not. So what I meant by talking about an economics-based approach is an approach within an explicit economic framework that gets those questions of fact addressed in relation to the allegations that there has been anti-competitive behavior, and that doesn't just leap to conclusions on the basis of the form of the conduct. And a good reason for that, there are many, but one is the last one there, the conduct of the same form in two different factual situations, conduct of the same description might be very good, very bad. You've got to look at the underlying facts in some economic context. Now, the last test would be not to relate it to the as efficient competitor test, but go directly to the question of whether the conduct is harmful to consumers. And some would take the view that you should never make a finding of unlawfulness in this area, of abusive behavior, unless there is a showing of at least in some sense, harm to consumers. That if there isn't harm to consumers in prospect, then it should not be against the law. Again, there is a big debate within the US, well, internationally, as well as in the European context, about that. Some people would take the view that abuse of dominance and other parts of competition law are not just about consumer harm. You can have separately, or conceptually separately, harm to the process of competition. So some would say that you should factor that in and not just questions of consumer harm. It's very controversial, in a sort of high-level question of whether or not you should do that. My own view on this is whether has to do partly with what types of consumer harm are we talking about and what is the standard of proof. If someone were very non-interventionist and say it's only high prices, restrictions of output that count, it's only proved harm, actual harm to consumers, that should count in the reckoning, and if you can't prove it, then there's no abuse. There I would say that's too conservative, non-interventionist approach, and if that's if that was the standard to which consumer harm had to be shown, I think there'd be a pretty good case for factoring in competitive process harm separately. But if there's a more embracing concept of harm to embrace quality, innovation, and so on, and where the standard of proof is not demonstrated harm or dangerously probable harm, but maybe balance of probability harm or a tendency from such conduct for there to be harm, or more weakly, possible harm, indeed some of the language in recent European court judgments have been more at that end of the spectrum, then I think the case for a separate heading of process harm, harm to the competitive process, is less, need for that. So I think there's a link between the standard of proof on the consumer harm, if you want to factor that in, and this question of process harms. Throughout, I think one should always guard against the danger of overly interventionist policy, which stands in the way of consumer benefits, chills pro-competitive, pro-consumer behavior, even though it might end up protecting certain competitors. I do subscribe to the general view at the bottom that the ultimate aim of competition law and policy should ultimately, at least in an ultimate sense, if not in a direct sense, be to serve the general public as consumers. So what I've done is to mention a few cases. I've done this very briefly. I've talked through three candidate underlying principles, which you can imagine being married together in different combinations. There are strands, traces on them, of them in the European case law and in the US case law, where there's been much more scholarly and other debate about this principle. And I mentioned it, one of these principles being advanced by the US Justice Department to the Supreme Court. You can't get higher level than that. There's been a much fuller debate in the US than there has been so far in the EU. It's high time we had that debate now in the EU. I strongly believe that we need to evolve the law in the way of a firm economics anchoring. That will align the law with its purpose. It will ensure that we don't have a victory of form over substance. And it will provide, if successful, clarity at a fundamental level. So my conclusion would be that the law needs a stronger basis, needs to evolve a stronger basis in economic principle, which will help casework and predictability in the process. But it's crucial in doing that. And here there's a very important thing that the economists must achieve. It's got to be practical in terms of how it is applied. I end by leaving the OFT website there where you can find this paper. I think there might be a web link through the LSE site too. It was a speech at a conference in Berlin I did in September, which talks about this in a bit more detail and has case and other and journal references for any of you who are interested in pursuing it more. Thank you very much.
My name is Giuseppe Mazzoni. I'm a consultant. I would like to understand how do you see the relationship between the UK law and the EU law in terms of subsidiarity? And if you think that the provision of the EU constitution, which says that three parliaments could block a proposal of the European Commission, if that is in the view of the national parliaments, it does not respect the principle of subsidiarity. So do you think this new provision will improve this concept of subsidiarity or not? I hope
okay,
it's
I mean
clear.
You're asking a big constitutional question, which is beyond beyond scope of what I was talking about. Let me try and answer in two parts. The UK Competition Act mirrors the European provisions, Article 82, also Article 81, which deals with anti-competitive agreements. And there is a section of the UK Act, Section 60, which says that the OFT and others and the courts applying that bit of domestic law need to behave, so far as is relevant, consistently with the principles of the European jurisprudence. Those are not the actual words. So there is a direct lining up in those terms. I don't see the EU constitution developments impinging on the way things have been. I mean, Mario Monti of course he's still the competition commissioner, though he had expected not to be by today. I mean, he said one of his proudest achievements is the preservation of the independence, of course, very much subject to the courts. You know, this is the competition directorate subject to the courts here. It's the OFT and others subject to the Competition Appeal Tribunal, the way they go about things. So I'd not seen any great change stemming from that, which I'm not a constitutional lawyer. Maybe I've missed something, but I hadn't seen it as changing things.
Well, there is a to define better what subsidiarity means.
Well, perhaps we talk about some subsidiarity another day, but yeah. This is about abuse of market power.
My name's John Fender. There's some recent economic literature. I'm thinking in particular of Agyon and Howard's paper, A Model of Creative Growth Through Creative Destruction, which suggests that monopoly, if not benign, is perhaps, when looked at in a dynamic context, perhaps far less harmful than the static economic position would suggest. The idea is that perhaps monopoly is inevitably temporary and will give rise to incentives for firms to carry out research and development and innovation to try to overturn that monopoly and so forth. So this line of argument would suggest that monopoly is perhaps far less harmful than would otherwise be thought. Has this line of thinking had any impact on anti-competition law, and what in your views are the implications of this line of thought? What should the implications be for anti-competition law?
Okay, well, that line of thought is most famously associated with Joseph Schumpeter. And I think one certainly needs to take away the lesson that one needs to look at the dynamics of competition, not just a static point of view. Remember, I said nowhere is there a law against the possession of monopoly power. And if somebody achieves market power through innovative activity or whatever and does not abuse it, I was talking about where is the line between what's abuse and not, then that's lawful too. I mean, your question puts me in a slightly embarrassing spot because Aguillon, Howitt, Harris, and me have a paper on exactly that in the Review of Economic Studies 2001, which didn't say what you just said. It was looking at how, contrary to the an extreme, a naive Schumpeterian, and of course Schumpeter was no such thing, that spiced up product market competition can intensify, not diminish, incentives to innovate, because I'm trying to get ahead of you to get the monopoly prize and so on. If I'm just coasting with a perpetual monopoly unthreatened, that is not a good recipe for pro-consumer, pro-efficiency behavior. If I'm under threat, and of course it's an empirical question, and as Schumpeter would say, you know, is the perennial gale of creative destruction blowing at my door, or am I just in the doldrums? That's a big issue. Now, those are grand questions, and when you've got a case in front of you, maybe the principles are informed by analysis as it evolves through the years. But I wouldn't see anything in the law that was at odds with the Schumpeterian point properly understood. And of course, there's evidence behind it. I mean, Aguillon, Blundell, and others not me, have an empirical paper looking at these issues too. And it's a kind of, they talk about an inverted U-shape relationship between innovative incentives and pressures and the degree of competition. So pure monopoly isn't the best recipe, neither is a thousand tiddly little firms. It's maybe the dynamics, depending on a million other things, might be optimized somewhere in between. But that's a long way from any particular competition law case.
Thanks. It's Chris Giles from the Financial Times. I was just wondering, given the Competition Act and the Enterprise Act, where you said there's made great gains for the UK economy in competition, and then you're saying there's a lack of definition in the Abusive Market Act, can you give us some evidence of just the scale of the gains from both those two pieces of law and the, I suppose, the damage by not having clarity in this latest Abuse of Market Power element?
Okay, these are all fascinating, grand, and unanswerable questions, but let me have a go. But my comment was that before March 2000, when the Competition Act came into force, the UK did not have the competition, fairly standard competition law prohibitions with serious teeth in terms of enforcement, including fines and scope for private actions going forward, dealing with anti-competitive agreements and abusive market power. And I think it's a good thing that we now have that. And it also makes sense in all sorts of other ways when we've had this European law. And, business engaged in international markets has been working within the rules of those European laws for decades. And it makes sense that in a seamless way we have domestic law lined up with that. Under the Enterprise Act, we also have potential for criminal sanctions on individuals proved to have been dishonestly engaged in the most hardcore form of cartel activity. And I think the deterrent effect of measures of that kind, deterrence against cartels, is a very important thing. That, if you like, is the stick, and along with it is the carrot of the leniency or amnesty arrangements, which has brought forward some very helpful information to the US authorities and to authorities in Europe. So I think that's a positive and sensible way to go. Now, in talking about the lack of clarity on abuse of market power, that has not stopped a number of cases being taken, including by the OFT. Some cases have led to findings that the law has been broken, and those have been challenged and up till now upheld in the Competition Appeal Tribunal on the substantive counts. And there are cases where we have deliberately and publicly made statements that we were not making a decision that the law had been broken, and we're explaining ourselves in those terms. I do think, though, that the decisional practice of the European Commission and some of the court judgments has left a band of uncertainty in this area. There are many conferences where legal practitioners will say that. I've obviously not done as in a deliberate way, but we've seen greater clarity and greater economic orientation with the bits of law dealing with with anti-competitive agreements, and in a slightly different way with mergers. And this is the next area where I think it's thoroughly welcome that the Commission is proposing to go that way. And member state authorities like the OFT are in the thick of those debates and seeking to contribute to them. I think we're in a situation where the two desirables of, in my view, a stronger economics basis and greater certainty, I think we're in a situation where we can have more of both. That sometimes advocates of the more formalistic approach to the law say, well, it's all very well to have more economics, but then that just creates legal uncertainty. Well, I don't think we're at that frontier where it's a choice between one or the other. I think we can have both. And that greater clarity about the underlying economic principles from the Commission and or the courts would be positive on both counts, including predictability and clarity.
So it just remains for me to thank John for a fascinating and informative lecture, and I think illustrates very well what happens when you get the combination of a deep knowledge of the academic literature and an opportunity to put those ideas into practice, which I'm sure is a rare thing, and we've been very privileged to hear from you this evening, John. Thank you very much.